From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, sitting CIA Director Mike Pompeo made some sit-up straight when he acknowledged that he'd been interviewed by FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller in Mueller's investigation into possible Trump campaign ties with the Russians. This was during Pompeo's confirmation hearing to become the next Secretary of State. Ranking Democrat Bob Menendez asked whether President Trump, in a private conversation last year, asked Pompeo to intervene in the FBI's Russia investigation. Here's Menendez first, then Pompeo.
Did he ask you to do anything as it relates to that investigation?
Senator, I don't recall. I don't recall what he asked me that day precisely. But I have to tell you, I'm with the president an awful lot. He has never asked me to do anything that I considered remotely improper.
When you say you're
Let's bring in NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Michelle, he doesn't remember what a president asked him to do?
Well, he was really careful not to talk in general about his private conversations with Trump about that. And the questions kept coming, Robin. You know, the other Democrats kept raising questions about his position on the Russia investigation. And, you know, Pompeo said, look, I'm the CIA director. I've been cooperating with the Mueller, with the other investigations on Capitol Hill. This is not the time to be talking about that. So he's clearly dodging those questions. Today.
Well, and can you tell us more about what Robert Mueller might have been asking him about in this acknowledgement that he was questioned?
Well, you know, as I said, he's the CIA director, so he would have the access to the intelligence that the U.S. has on Russia's meddling here in the U.S. elections and the response in general to how to deal with Russia and push back in the future.
Yeah. Well, we don't know, but it could have been that same meeting that Menendez was asking him about, but we don't know. One Democrat going in, the Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, expressed concerns that after meeting with Pompeo on Tuesday, Pompeo wasn't well-versed on world affairs. Now, Pompeo pledged to empower a demoralized diplomatic corps, and despite his reputation as a hawk, he told senators on this Foreign Relations Committee meeting that war is always the last resort. But with that concern from that senator going in, how did Mike Pompeo do?
Well, he really did his homework. He's making a case for a quick confirmation, though perhaps being a bit too ambitious about that. You know, there's a lot of pressing issues on this administration's plate right now, Robin. Some key decisions have to be made. Trump has said he wants to meet Kim Jong-un on North Korea, possibly as early as May. That month, the Trump administration also has to weigh in again on the Iran nuclear deal. And the State Department has been involved in negotiations about that. Cardin told us this week that he felt he knew more about the status of those negotiations with the Europeans than Pompeo did. Those were some of the questions that were being raised again today.
Well, Mike Pompeo is also an evangelical Christian who's portrayed the fight against terrorism as a kind of a holy war perpetrated by people who believe that Islam is the way. And here he is speaking about that to a church group in 2014.
We need to recognize that these folks believe that it is religiously driven for them to wipe Christians from the face of the earth, and will continue to press against us until we make sure that we pray and stand and fight and make sure that we know that Jesus Christ as our Savior is truly the only solution for our world.
It's interesting, Robin, you know, as a former congressman, Pompeo certainly has a track record of a lot of past statements, so he has a lot of explaining to do on that. But being a former congressman has also helped him in his ability to reach out to Congress now. He spent a lot of time promising to keep Congress in the loop if he's confirmed as Secretary of State and to work to rebuild the status of the State Department. Rex Tillerson, who was fired earlier this year, was not adept at all at that.
Well, a committee chair and Trump critic, Bob Corker, joined Democrats, he's a Republican, in questioning whether Pompeo would stand up to President Trump. Now, this morning, President Trump tweeted that an attack on Syria, which could also hit the forces of ally Russia, Syria's ally, could be very soon or not soon at all. And, Pompeo was asked, what is your stand on Russia, on Syria? What did he say?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Corker was talking about this, you know, when the leader of a country speaks, he must choose his words carefully. And he wants Pompeo to be that voice of reason behind him. You know, that's something that he's trying to present himself as being in this hearing today.
Did he say that he would be maybe tougher on Russia than the president is? Probably not.
He says that that this administration is tough on Russia. He says that it's a soft policy of the past that has made Russia so aggressive. And he said that time is now over.
Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
And lawmakers in the House today are voting on a constitutional amendment. It would require the government to balance the budget every year and not spend more than it takes in. It's not likely to become law, but Republicans are pushing for it after passing a $1.5 trillion tax cut last year and passing a $1.3 trillion bipartisan spending bill last month that increases military and domestic spending. A new report from the Congressional Budget Office projects these laws will make the federal deficit exceed $1 trillion in the next 2 years. Republican Congressman David Bratt represents Virginia's 7th Congressional District. He strongly supports the balanced budget amendment. He also voted in favor of the GOP tax cuts and voted against the omnibus spending bill. Congressman, welcome.
Hey, you bet. Thanks for having me on.
The constitutional amendment to mandate a balanced budget would require support from 2/3 of the House and the Senate to amend the Constitution. I wonder if you think this is likely to happen and whether or not it's worth bringing up for a vote.
Yeah, it's a pretty high hurdle. So, you know, you can keep your fingers crossed. But I think it's valuable just to see, you know, put us all on record on a vote to see, you know, who's putting their voting card in for fiscal responsibility. So I think for that alone, it's worthwhile putting up.
Well, it's said by some that this would be kind of a fig leaf for fiscal responsibility. Do you actually think it would make a difference?
Well, we just got done blowing a hole in the budget. So whether it's a fig leaf or not, we don't have a good track record, right? So it kind of started. We did the tax cuts for $150 billion a year. And if you grow at 3%, those are paid for, right? And then at the end of the year, we had, in order to get Democrats and Republicans on the same page, you had to increase government spending by $400 billion. And so I think this is a statement that, hey, we're heading in the wrong direction big time. And both parties need to get together behind closed doors, right, because it's all political. And we've got to work on this for the sake of the kids.
I just want to point out the latest report from the Congressional Budget Office says that the cuts will increase the size of the economy, but that growth will not come close to making up for the huge cost of the cuts. They say that they'll add up to more than $1.8 trillion to the deficit over a decade. When you call for fiscal responsibility, and that is a hallmark of your career, how could you vote for something that will balloon the deficit even more?
Yeah, well, just to correct you, I taught economics and got a PhD in economics. I talked with
the
Chicago guys. CBO is correct that the tax bill itself will not pay for it. It'll pay for 0.3, right? It'll pay for about a third of it. But our agenda with deregulation, the proper way to put it is if you grow at 3%, it does pay for the tax cut bill. So CBO just scores a narrow tax bill. That's their job. And I have asked them to score, and we're meeting with them right now in Budget Committee, to score the Republican agenda as a totality.
The progressive research nonprofit Center for American Progress finds that the constitutional amendment would result in drastic cuts to Social Security, to Medicare, and to Medicaid. Will it?
Not if we get serious about those programs, right? I mean, they were set up 40, 50 years ago when the average death age was 65, and now the average death age is 83, right? So people start getting the benefits at 62 or 65 and live to be 83. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see why they're bankrupt.
Do you think that we should be increasing in this country the age of eligibility for Medicare and Social Security?
Well, that's what I just kind of gave the analogy. And when Paul Ryan has put that down on paper, the Democrats run ads of him pushing grandma off the cliff. And so the answer to that question is highly political. We need both parties not to be running negative ads, but to get in a room together and try to solve that problem.
And how would you solve it?
The numbers
it?
Are clear. Either the tax rates would have to go through the roof or else the ages have to change or some combination of them.
Right, or fewer of the tax cuts that are being implemented. But what would you say? Do you think
I differ with you on that one. That the economic growth part cannot be underestimated. If we don't get that part, we're in deep trouble.
So it is a political football, certainly. But how would you vote if it came to the idea of raising the age of eligibility for the entitlements?
There's nothing up for voting on that, right? That's what I'm saying. Right now, you better have the Democrats need to put some people in the room on that one and ask them the same question.
Right. And how would you – I mean, it sounds like you're reluctant to answer it. Would you support such a move?
Well, you asked me it four times, and I told you the answer. The answer is you got to do that in a closed room with Democrats. And the Democrats have to decide to quit running negative ads against Paul Ryan and anyone that proposes solutions to extend the life of these programs.
Congressman David Brad, Republican of Virginia, thank you very much.
Awesome. You bet. Thanks for having me.
Recently, the Trump administration began exploring rolling back the 2014 Obama guidelines for school discipline. Now, they were put in place to try to reduce the documented racial disparities in how students are disciplined, and Minneapolis has become ground zero for that debate. Last year, black students made up just 41% of the student population there, but 76% of the students suspended. In one school, black students were 338% more likely to be suspended than their white peers, according to the New York Times. And in February, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights notified 43 school districts that their suspension rates for nonviolent offenses suggested discrimination, and those suspensions started in preschool. We're going to speak to two educators. First, a former Minneapolis superintendent. She is African-American and says she tried to address the so-called discipline gap with things like restorative justice, a chance to make up for behavior, rather than expulsions. But she resigned after the backlash. Bernadia Johnson is now a professor of education at Minnesota State University. She joins us by Skype. Professor Bernadia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Bernadia, as a woman of color, this was not a surprise to you. You say this is something talked about around the dining room table. But as an educator, what were you seeing in the way young black kids and white kids were approached when it comes to discipline?
So if you were a white student and you were being naughty, you were called precocious, bright, someone who is inquisitive. And you're a black child, it was everything that you would think of as negative, like you're a thug, you know, you're just not meant for school or whatever the case may be. And if you go deeper around that, is that they already determined what the student's future would be. So you saw some of those differences in how people would explain away behaviors.
Well, you've given examples, young black kids, ninth graders, who, you know, had some playful jabs, but it escalated into a fight. Neither hurt, no property damage. They were suspended. Separate incident, another school. Another white middle school student became upset and kicked in a door.
You know, they gave him a little time out. But I know that if there had been a black child that destroyed property, he or she would have been suspended. And the reason I know, because I reviewed every suspension in Minneapolis public schools.
Well, you know that there are people listening here and thinking, it's not that they're disproportionately punished. It's that they disproportionately misbehave, young blacks, more than their white peers. But you point to research that shows that's not true.
It's not the case. It's not the case. It's how we view the behavior and how we decide upon the consequences that are different, which ends up making the data look like black kids are misbehaving more. I'm saying that we don't call behavior out equally when we see it.
So, for instance, there's a North Carolina study that found that there was equal use of cell phones, but 8 times higher punishment for black students. Black students were suspended at a rate 6 times higher than white students for dress code violations. So what did you decide to try to do?
So my ultimate goal was to change the trajectory of the child's experience. I wanted more engaged students. I wanted students to have trusting relationships with adults. I wanted them to participate in their educational experience. And I wanted them to be looked at as human beings and not as some anomaly. But what was most surprising to me is when I looked at the suspensions of preschoolers and kindergarten and first grade students. And that's when I decided to put a moratorium on suspending kids for nonviolent behaviors, especially our littlest learners. All our kids are learning what it means to become an adult, and our job is to socialize them into the school environment so that they know what's expected of them and And sometimes I've seen that students have been suspended because of inconsistent expectations among teachers, among the schools.
But sometimes students are a problem, and I want to get to that. But I just want to stay with, so your plan was no suspensions for little kids, which, you know, that kind of rejection at that age, you know, those on your side say, if we're supposed to be educating them and socializing them, why would you send them out of the building? They should be in the building for that. And you give an example, for instance, of, you know, if there's a no hats in schools rule, what would you say rather than suspensions?
I've actually gone to the student, pulled him or her aside and said, you know, one of the rules that we agreed upon is that you don't wear hats in school. And invariably, you'll find out that the kid maybe was getting her hair braided the night before and it wasn't finished, and they didn't want to be embarrassed. So they'd rather face the wrath of the teacher, the school, than embarrass themselves by not looking put together like they want to. And so in those cases, I've actually said to the teachers of the kid and to the student is that, today, you can wear your hat. You have a special pass from me to be able to do that. And I think that's all about relationships, too, connecting with students. And discipline is not about punishment. It's about learning.
That's Bernadia Johnson, now a professor of education at Minnesota State University, but the former superintendent in Minneapolis who tried to bring a change in thinking to discipline for kids of color. Federal investigators in 2014 found that a black second grade student was suspended for poking another student with a pencil, but a white second grader who threw a rock, hit a student, broke a teacher's glasses, was not suspended. Just last month, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights found 43 school districts and charter schools with suspension rates for nonviolent offenses that indicated discriminatory practices. I want to bring in Jeffrey Parker now. He's a special ed teacher in St. Paul, Minnesota. Jeff, you were hearing the former superintendent say that she thought some of this was because teachers sometimes bring a mindset to school. Do you find yourself ever catching yourself saying, wait a second, am I reacting more or differently because this child is of color? Are you seeing, you know, other teachers do it?
Oh, yes. It's prevalent. And I think it's to a certain degree, that's human nature. We're all going to make judgments. Perception is what makes misbehavior misbehavior. And to deny that, I think, would be to miss a very, very important point. I think it bears mentioning that I am a black man, and that creates an entirely different set of thoughts and expectations in my mind that I have to address daily.
Well, first of all, we had no idea that you're African American. So tell us more. What are those unique thoughts and expectations?
In the back of my mind, I hear my parents talking about the idea of behavior. My dad used to say, you got to keep your nose clean. If you're not going to keep your nose clean, keep a handkerchief, meaning you need to be able to clean up your mess. Mm. I was taught how to do that. Not everyone was taught how to do that. And I would hear a lot of black colleagues and a lot of black parents putting even more pressure on students to do, quote unquote, the right thing. They also wanted some pretty severe penalties for wrongdoing.
So, Jeff, it sounds as if you're saying that there is both bias, you know, that you've seen, but also maybe a sense of, as a black teacher, wanting to be firmer with the black students because they do have so many societal challenges. You want to help them to succeed.
Yes. And again, I have to be aware of that on a daily basis. Our communities also have that reflection of wrongdoing needs to be punished. The entire restorative justice movement that started in the 90s kind of began on that premise. Not what can we do to punish wrongdoing, but how can we respond to wrongdoing in a way that's going to benefit the individual and the community?
Well, you know, some schools have started restorative justice courts so that kids who have wronged each other can come together in a court with their peers and resolve it that way. So they're actually working it out instead of banishing one or the other. Bernadia Johnson, I want to bring you back in. Again, former superintendent and now a professor of education who tried to bring some reforms to close the discipline gap. That's fascinating because this is not discriminatory in the way that we think of it.
I hear what Jeff is saying, and I understand that. I agree with Jeff. White parents and black parents have different ideas about discipline, and they're strict disciplinarians. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the biases that a teacher brings into the room in the context of teaching students. What is it he wants for them, and how is he going to run his learning environment? I bet you'd hardly ever send a kid out. And when they go out, you have to repair those relationships. The kid did it. You suspended him. He's back, and you're still angry. You got to let that go.
Well, you try to do this. You tried to bring in tactics like restorative justice and restorative schools, circles between students and teachers.
All these different strategies that don't let a kid off the hook. We're not saying that kids should not have consequences, but there should be consequences that are relative to what happened. So what people would suggest now is that we can't discipline kids. Yes, you can. You can teach kids appropriate behaviors. You can hold them accountable to that. But sending a kid home is not teaching the child. If they're out of the learning environment, how can they excel? How can they grasp the academic work that you are giving to them?
Well, but what do you say to fellow teachers who are going to Washington to lobby the Trump administration to roll back the Obama-era rules that were meant to close this discipline gap? They say they want to be able to suspend. They want to be able to expel. And they say they're not racist or biased. But they say they have violence in their classroom. One of the teachers, I'm sure you know, Debbie York, she retired after being injured when a first grader pushed her. She says teachers need options for those kids that go beyond getting them therapy or some kind of a rehabilitative courtroom.
There are students sometimes need to be removed from the environment if it's unsafe and they make it unsafe for others. And again, my emphasis was on nonviolent. And the fact of the matter is, besides the restorative justice and other ways of addressing this, we also partnered with the county, Hennepin County, and put mental health support and services in all of our K-8 schools and all of our middle schools. So leaders have to think about different ways of reacting and responding as well.
That's Bernadia Johnson, now a professor of education at Minnesota State University, former superintendent who tried to institute changes in that school district. Also, Jeffrey Parker, special education teacher in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you both for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
You're certainly welcome.
So, teachers, have you recognized a bias in your disciplining? Or do you resent these findings? And is there a better way to discipline all kids than sending them away from school? Or is that sometimes the safest choice? Weigh in, hereandnow.org.
The NBA's regular season came to an end last night, and now it's time for the playoffs. They start this weekend. The big question for pro basketball fans is whether anyone can unseat the Golden State Warriors, the defending NBA champs. The man with the answer, maybe, is here and now sports analyst Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. So the Warriors are stumbling into the playoffs. They lost 10 of their past 17 games. Are they really unseatable?
Oh, I do have the answer. And the answer is yes, they can be beaten. And it's not just because of their recent woes. Their recent woes can be explained by injury. And Steph Curry, their former MVP guard, all-world player, is hurt. He won't be there in the first round of the playoffs. He's days away from even analyzing if he'll be able to play in the second round. And that affects the team chemistry. There are also other very good teams. So yes, I would say the Warriors are vulnerable. They would say, look, we've been locked into a second seed in the playoff for many, many weeks. There's not so much of an incentive to play hard. You're going to see us, the Warriors, and their coach Steve Kerr is trying to assure fans, you're going to see who we really are in this first round of the playoffs. We'll see. And beyond the first round, you know, the Houston Rockets are looming out there as the number one seed in the West.
Huge Houston Rockets. Is it their turn this year, do you think?
It very well may be. James Harden, who I think is going to be the MVP and is the scoring champion, is just such a dynamic player. And they have put together a fantastic team that plays offense and defense well. Right now, Las Vegas is saying that they are the favorite to win the NBA championship.
And are there any other teams in the West? We're talking about the Western Conference. Any others that pose a threat, do you think?
You know, I do think there is another team. Now, the third seed in the West is Portland, and the fourth seed in the West is Oklahoma City. But I want to talk about the fifth seed in the West, the Utah Jazz, because they're on a winning streak. They have a fantastic center, Rudy Gobert, who is French, and they call him the Eiffel Tower. I like that. And I don't know, because the Warriors are good and the Rockets are very good, and they'd have to go through those two teams to get to the finals. But to me, the Jazz are a dark horse. Now, do I say this because I was in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago and put a bet on them at 175-1 odds.
Yes.
Maybe that's why. Maybe that's affecting my perception. But if they win, I do get $880. So that's good on a $5 bet.
At least you're coming clean, Mike.
That's right.
How about the
full
Eastern
disclosure?
In the Eastern Conference, the conversation always starts with LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavs are in the playoffs, but there were other teams with regular seasons that were better. Their records are better. So what are their playoff prospects?
The Cavaliers don't have great playoff prospects because other than LeBron, who just recently put together one of the greatest 20 or 25 game stretches of his career, but he's never had a worse supporting cast. And I think this even goes back to his early days with the Warriors before he defected or made a business decision to take his talents to South Beach. So I do think, but for LeBron, that is the weakest lineup in the East. Now, saying but for LeBron is like saying, you know, but for those big faces on Mount Rushmore, the Black Hills is kind of an uninteresting mountain range, right? LeBron's pretty, pretty good. However, the Toronto Raptors, the number one seed in the East, they are as dominant in their conference, certainly as the Rockets are in theirs. I know they're from Toronto. I know they don't get a lot of attention, but they're an excellent basketball team.
Okay, 5 seconds on the Philadelphia 76ers.
They're streaking. They have 16 wins. They're exciting. Markelle Fultz, their point guard, just had a triple-double. They could win the East for sure.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst, hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. I think it was 7 seconds, but that's okay. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
For about 10 hours this week, Mark Zuckerberg took questions from lawmakers looking to find out just how his company Facebook works and how it handles privacy for 2 billion users around the world. Questions about who owns data, how did the Steve Bannon-founded political firm Cambridge Analytica collect information on millions of users? And then there's Diamond and Silk, two African-American Trump supporters who claim that Facebook is censoring them because they are Black, unlike Donald Trump. Some of the questions were pointed. Others sounded a little like a high-profile tech support call between Zuckerberg and lawmakers decades older. So what did a tech reporter think? Well, let's start at the beginning. Zuckerberg opened by saying he created Facebook to make tools for good.
It's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry. I started Facebook, I run it, and I'm responsible for what happens here.
So Mark Zuckerberg started with a mea culpa. Let's bring in Kurt Wagner. He sat in on both of the hearings this week and covers Facebook for Recode. Kurt, speak for the technical world. Do people like you think you heard what you needed to hear from Mark Zuckerberg this week?
I think if you talk to folks in the tech world, the feedback that I've been getting and my takeaway from being in the room was that a lot of the questions were pretty high level. They weren't necessarily the detailed probing questions that someone who's very familiar with Facebook and the tech industry might ask. It seemed very clear that a lot of the politicians either had a very, you know, elementary understanding of how Facebook works or no understanding at all. So A lot of the time, Mark Zuckerberg ended up just kind of repeating things that if you followed Facebook closely, you already knew. At the same time, I think that shows the bigger picture, right, which is that a lot of people still just don't understand Facebook.
Right. I mean, they do maybe represent the people they represent in that way. Let's listen to one, Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, who seemed to struggle with what users can and cannot control.
Are you willing, as a Facebook user, are you willing to give me more control over my data?
Senator, as someone who uses Facebook, I believe that you should have complete control over your data.
Okay. Are you willing to go back and work on giving me a greater right to erase my data?
Senator, you can already delete any of the data that's there or delete all of your data.
Are you willing to expand that, work on expanding that?
Senator, I think we already do what you're referring to, but certainly we're always working on trying to make these controls easier.
Kurt, what are the problems there? I mean, the question, for instance, of Cambridge Analytica, they got data from somebody who legally scooped up data from Facebook through an app. So, you know, what would you have wanted the questions to be?
Yeah, that's some of the nuance here, right? Is that the act of actually collecting the data was not against Facebook's rules. In fact, the professor who did collect all this data did so within the confines of the rules. That was not the problem. The problem was that he then turned around and sold that data to someone else, right? He profited off the data in a way that violated Facebook's terms. I think what we didn't hear enough of was the way that Facebook really collects stuff that people don't even know that they're collecting, right? So, for example, your browser history, if you're going around the web looking at other websites, there's a lot of information about that activity that Facebook ultimately has and then can use you to target you with ads. And I think that that's a very complicated topic. And it was addressed off and on, but it wasn't really hammered home in the way that I'm sure for those people who maybe cover the tech industry might have done had they had more time.
Well, and there were several moments in which lawmakers turned their focus to the larger picture and Facebook's size. Comparisons were made to Ma Bell, which used to be called the telephone company. It was the kind of the only telephone company, and Standard Oil, and companies that were broken up. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina zeroed in on this. So did House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Greg Walden. Here he is yesterday.
Facebook has created its own video series starring Tom Brady that ran for 6 episodes and has over 50 million views. Also, Facebook's obtained exclusive broadcasting rights for 25 Major League Baseball games this season. Is Facebook a media company?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I consider us to be a technology company because the primary thing that we do is have engineers who write code and build products and services for other people. There are certainly other things that we do, too. We do pay to help produce content. We build enterprise software, although I don't consider us an enterprise software company. We build planes to help connect people, and I don't consider ourselves to be an aerospace company. But overall, when people ask us if we're a media company, what I hear is, do we have a responsibility for the content that people share on Facebook? And I believe the answer to that question is yes.
So, Kurt, we've got two issues going on here. We had congresspeople questioning whether or not Facebook is a monopoly. Should it be broken up? Does it have too much control over a market? And then also the question of what kind of a company is it? Is it a media company? How did these questions resonate for you, a tech writer?
I think they're incredibly important questions. I think the monopoly thing really stood out. It was addressed on both days of the hearing. Mark Zuckerberg was asked, who's your biggest competition? And he really didn't have a good answer to that question. And I think when you look at the landscape of different services that do what Facebook does, there's really nobody that comes close. And so I think that kind of puts a target on Facebook's back in terms of regulation and certainly much more scrutiny than has been applied now. And I think the reason that this media question comes into play in the same kind of conversation is that media companies are regulated differently than tech companies, right? There is more responsibility if you're a media company to control what shows up on your service and also, you could be penalized for what shows up on your service. So I think that is why Facebook has always been very kind of weary of identifying itself as a media company, even though a lot of other people would certainly put them in that bucket. But I think ultimately, what ties these two together is more regulation, right? How is Facebook going to be controlled by the government? Will there be more regulations put in place?
And did we hear anything about what that might look like? For instance, a lot of people talked about transparency. Facebook's already saying we're going to have ways where you can know, where your information is going on apps and things. But did we hear over those hearings what that regulation might look like?
So I'm not convinced that there's any one central belief among all of the politicians that something will get done. I think there's a lot of ideas. There almost might be too many ideas because I'm not sure you can pass all of them. But the one kind of theme that continued to stick out to me was this notion of opting in to share your data versus opting out. So the way most companies collect data now is what's called opt out. They collect it by default and you have to specifically tell them to stop doing that. A lot of the politicians this week were suggesting, hey, Facebook, you should be collecting everything opt-in. You should never take someone's data, a piece of their data, before they give you explicit permission to do so. And that's a big deal, right? Because Facebook gets a lot of its data from people who just don't opt out. So that could be something that we could see down the line. I think more immediate, what we've already seen was some bills that were brought last fall that would kind of regulate advertising around campaigns. So political advertising on Facebook would need to have more disclosures and things like that. I think that's a more realistic thing in the near term. The opt-in, opt-out data collection could be something down the line, and I think that would be a really big deal for Facebook.
So question to you, can Facebook be Facebook? Can they make the tons of money that they make and please their many shareholders if they allow users to opt out of apps that take their data? I know they have the advertising too, but that's their financial model.
It's an important question, and it's one that we won't know until some type of rules have actually been put forward, right, to see what this would look like. I do think that Facebook is probably going to be okay, because I think a lot of people, believe it or not, are okay sharing that data with Facebook, right? They, as long as they know that they're doing it, I think people are more okay with it than you would think. I think the service has gotten ingrained in so many people's lives to this point. I mean, it's used by more than 2 billion people around the world, that people aren't just going to walk away from that. They have the last 10 years of their life plastered and saved to this website, right?
Well, that just brings another question. People asked about this. You say they have their life plastered on that website. Can they take it with them?
That's the way it's set up now. Yeah, you're allowed to delete your Facebook data. You're allowed to download all of it. I just did it last week, actually. It is a little alarming to see how much you have shared with the site and how much they do know about you. But you can download it right to your computer and take it wherever you want.
Did you do it because you left?
I didn't leave. No, I'm still a Facebook user. Since I cover the company, I feel like I should stick around and use it. But I did want to see what they had collected on me. So you can do it even if you don't leave the service.
Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So this week, what questions did you wish you could have asked Mark Zuckerberg? What answers from Zuckerberg weren't satisfying for you? Let us know. hereandnow.org.
There's a new museum in New York City that examines the Holocaust from the perspective of Orthodox Jews. The museum is mostly staffed by the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. Its focus isn't on observant Jews as victims of Nazi persecution. It's on how they managed to continue their religious observances under the most horrific conditions. John Kalish reports from Brooklyn.
The Ahmed Aish Memorial Museum is located in a decidedly non-Orthodox neighborhood in Brooklyn. There are no visible signs alerting visitors that they've arrived at the museum. A receptionist in the lobby buzzes people into the 1,000-square-foot ground-floor exhibition space. The museum's director is Rabbi Sholem Friedman, the son of a Belgian Holocaust survivor. Friedman completed a fellowship in Holocaust education at the Imperial War Museum in London.
People oftentimes relegate the Orthodox story of the Holocaust to what's referred to as spiritual resistance. I don't think that that's an appropriate term. Orthodox Jews maintaining their faith was not a form of resistance. It was an act of what Orthodox Jews had been brought up and trained to do. Regardless of the situation, they're doing it because this is how we behave and this is how we practice our faith.
Rabbi Friedman came up with the name Ahmed Aish, which is Hebrew for pillar of fire. It's a reference to the flames that were said to have guided Jews in biblical times as they wandered the desert at night during the Exodus from Egypt. The museum's mission statement declares that the lessons of the Holocaust are a guiding light for us.
The Orthodox community as a whole has always viewed history really to look back to history, to learn from history what relevant lessons we can apply to today. That's with a particular interest in not so much the persecution that occurred, but to the victim's response to the persecution.
Friedman concedes that museums do not play a big role in the Orthodox community, but he hopes Ahmed Aish will introduce the legitimacy of the museum as an educational resource. He insists that this museum is not rewriting the narrative of the Holocaust, rather it's including the story of observant Jews in that narrative.
The Orthodox community's story throughout the Holocaust is really not well documented, and there's a lot to be mined within that story.
The museum's current exhibit focuses on Jews who escaped the Nazis by going to Shanghai. On display are documents that tell the story of students from the famed Lublin Yeshiva in Poland who made a month-long walk to Vilna in Lithuania after Germany invaded Poland in 1939. In a display case, there's a ticket good for a meal at a soup kitchen in Vilna.
You got that from the Jewish Refugee Committee in Vilna. You were starving for food.
The ticket for a meal at a soup kitchen in Vilna was loaned to the museum by Yehuda Gelbfish, son of the late Benjamin Gelbfish, one of the Lublin Yeshiva students.
You got a soup ticket, you went to the soup kitchen, you got a bowl of soup. It was your survival. It happened to have been one day, though my father was very hungry, he was called to the Russians, and he spent hours being interviewed, and he missed his bowl of soup for that day. What do you do with your soup ticket? You save it.
Benjamin Gelbfish compulsively held on to documentation, including his laundry receipt and a ticket booklet for the Trans-Siberian Railroad. He did make it to Shanghai and came to America after the war, where he made his living as a watchmaker and later a jewelry manufacturer in New Jersey.
God was always on his lips. My father took everything God sent him, and he would say this all the time, is you take what God gave you, you learn from it, and you move on.
Several members of Ahmed Aish's staff of nine had parents or grandparents who were Holocaust survivors. Chavi Felsenberg's grandmother was a hidden child during the Holocaust, and her grandfather survived six concentration camps. Felsenberg is the museum's acquisitions curator.
A woman called me up. She said, I have something, but I'm embarrassed to actually donate it. So what is it? So she said, I have a duffel bag. She said, I have used the duffel bag. My kids have used the duffel bag going to camp. Our name is written with red ink on the duffel bag. So what was it made of? It was made of the uniform that the prisoners wore in the concentration camps. So her uncle's uniform was turned into a duffel bag.
The museum's director of research and archives is David Rydell, a rabbi in the Bubaver Hasidic sect. He says many of the donations to the museum have been sitting in attics or basements for 60 or 70 years.
These are families that never felt comfortable giving it to the secular museums. And finally, they feel this is a museum that gets them.
Rydell, it turns out, is the grandson of a religious Brooklyn businessman who violated the Jewish law prohibiting travel on the Sabbath by meeting with First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt on a Saturday. Observant Jews believe the desecration of the Sabbath is warranted for the sake of saving a human life. Rydell's grandfather was successful in obtaining a visa for a Lithuanian rabbi who made it to America and established a yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey. Today, it's considered the largest Jewish religious school in the world. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.